Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed...
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good.
Oh, I think I know where that one came from.
Yeah, we are going to tackle a subject that a lot of listeners have asked us to talk about, both on Facebook and in email, possibly on Twitter as well. But we've received many requests to talk about the dot-com bubble and crash of 2000-2001. And it's an interesting story, and it certainly has some lessons that we can learn, particularly with certain companies that are operating right now.
That's absolutely true. I have the occasion to work in technology during the dot-com bubble years, and it was a crazy ride.
Yeah, it was a very exciting time for a while, and then it was a very terrifying time.
But to
build into this, we should really kind of give you a bird's-eye view of what was going on at the time. So the World Wide Web really started to make penetration into the public in 93 or so.
Yeah, it's funny because a lot of people, I think, still really have no idea that the Internet was born decades, really, before you know, we were all using the web for, you know, keeping up with everyone and you know, communications of different kinds. But yeah, I mean, that once the web arrived on the scene, that really enabled a lot of people to do things that with computers that they wouldn't necessarily have done. So I remember, it's funny because I was thinking about this on my way into the studio this morning. There was a game show I was watching, and I think it was Alan Ludden who was hosting. It's one of the older shows on Game Show Network.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the prizes was a home computer. And this was in the probably late 1980s when the show was from. And he's like, okay, well, if you want to – I'm paraphrasing because it's been so long. But you've won a personal home computer, although I don't know what you would do with something like that. Which cracks me up now because the internet and especially the web has made it possible to do so many different kinds of things like online banking and watching shows and keeping up with calendars and reading the news and
all kinds of friends.
Yeah, but we didn't do that before. And once the web came around, people started going, wait, I know, you could make a, you know, fill in the blank here. And there wasn't one already. You didn't say, you know, I can make an online banking site. Oh, no, you know. The giant World Bank has already done that. Well, maybe I could come up with a way to network with my friends. No, there's already a Facebook.
Right, yeah.
You know, these people were creating these things from scratch, and it was a really heady time because everybody wanted to be the first in and make loads of money from doing this, although they didn't really necessarily know how.
Right. I equate the early days of the web, and really, even though 93 was when the public started getting hold of the web, 95 is when businesses started to really look at how can we use this as a way to make money, or not just businesses looking into it, but people looking into it thinking, how can I form a business that uses the web as a platform?
Yes.
But I equate it to a land grab. Like imagine that you have come to a new country and there's a huge territory that is open and it has a set amount of land that's available for a set price, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's divided up into certain sections. And then essentially on a certain day, you are allowed to go and stake your claim. You would actually go and you would stake your claim, put it, you know, say this land is what I'm purchasing, and that would become yours.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's risk involved in that because you might go and grab land and then find out that you thought that maybe there'd be a good place to dig a well. And it turns out there is no good place to dig a well on that land. Or, you know, you thought that the land, that the section you grabbed was going to be great for farming. And then you realize, oh, wait, 75% of this is really rocky ground that's not going to be easy to farm at all. Same sort of thing with the web, really, is this idea, this frontier that had been mostly unoccupied, mm-hmm. especially from a business perspective. And it gave people the idea that anything is possible. And as long as I have a good idea, I can build up a customer base. And once I build up my customer base, I can find a way to make money from them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was kind of the problem, is that they first thought, I need to get people. And then I need to figure out how to make money from them.
Yep, yep. And I think it bears going into also. It wasn't just the tech sector, the people within the tech sector who were excited about this. In the mid-90s, that's when people started getting really excited about internet access and getting home computers so that they could use the internet at their homes.
Right.
And once people realized this, they started thinking, you know what? I bet these companies, you know, they might be worth something someday, especially because I think people were saying, hey, you've really got something here.
Right.
So a lot of these companies would issue stock to join the stock market. And I was looking into this last night as I was doing my research. Andrew Beatty wrote an article about bubbles for Investopedia.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to just give you the definition of a bubble based on his article. You know, he actually wrote about a lot of different famous bubbles that have happened, a lot of them in real estate. You know, there are many bubbles,
sure.
Not just this one.
Sure.
But the idea is that people are really excited about a product that is on the stock market.
Sure.
And they're so excited that they keep buying it. They want more stock, as much stock as they can get. And that drives the price of the stock up. And eventually, though, the company, the actual worth of the company can't match what the perceived value is in the stock market.
Right.
And it keeps inflating and inflating and inflating. And so there's a company might be worth, say, $20 million, but it has, you know, on the stock market, it's far more than that.
Yeah,
so eventually,
$100 million in shares out.
Exactly. And at some point, when the company falters, the bubble can burst. People suddenly realize, oh my gosh, this company is not worth but that much.
Yeah, it's under.
They sell their stock.
Exactly. And then you end up with a company where it starts to fall apart. We call this whole idea speculation, right?
It's
stock market speculation. And speculation is essentially when you bet, it's usually related to short-term gains.
Yes.
You know, you're looking at the stock market momentum, and you're not necessarily, a lot of the people who were investing weren't necessarily looking into companies they were particularly interested in. They were betting that the company they were investing in was going to explode, and that it would either become wildly successful, in which case you become rich, or it would get acquired by a bigger company, in which case you get rich. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like a no-brainer. You know, you throw in money at these small companies as soon as they become available, and then you just watch your cash increase. But the problem is that when more and more people get involved in this speculation, it does drive the price up, and it mm-hmm. drives it up well beyond the company's worth, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very high risk. It's fast paced. If you want to indulge in being a speculator on the stock market, you have the potential to make a lot of money, but you have to be really nimble, and people are not going to like you.
Yeah.
Because you're not investing in a company in order to have that company succeed. You're investing in a company kind of like if you were in Las Vegas and you were making a bet on a poker game.
Right, right. Now, of course, it's not as simple as coming up with an idea in your bedroom one night, writing it down, sketching it up on a napkin for five friends, and then starting the company the next day and then becoming rich.
Right.
There's many, many steps in between. The piece that you may be missing if you're unfamiliar with a lot of this is the venture capitalists.
Yes.
And these are people who are business people looking to make initial investments. You know, you have your five friends with you. You've started your company, but you know, all of you have maxed out your credit cards trying to get this thing off the ground. And you say, well, you know, where am I going to come up with some money? I'm scratching my head, but you can't see it.
Yeah.
And a nice visual. You go, well, what am I going to do? Well, these venture capitalists might want to talk to you. You might go into the boardroom, meet with the people at the firm and say, look, here's our idea. These are the five things you want to accomplish to do it. We figure we're going to need, you know, $15 million to really tool up and make this thing a possibility. If you can convince those investors, those initial investors, that you really have a case, they might be willing to give you some money and to get the company started. So then you could go ahead and rent some office space, get your, you know, copier and your computers, and, you know, hire a couple people to help you along.
Pay your ISP.
Yeah, yeah. You've got a lot of overhead costs that you got to take care of. These initial investments come from these venture capitalists. And I was reading on an article in the San Francisco Chronicle by Tom Abate, who did a piece on the dot-com bubble, and was saying that venture capital firms were just going nuts funding this. In fact, one of my supervisors when I worked for a tech company left to join a venture capital firm. We all thought that was really cool, which it was
at the time.
But this was a no-brainer. They were coming up with the greatest ideas, you know, fresh off the right out of the factory, if you will.
Yeah.
And they were. He said that Abate said that venture capitalists in 2000 made about 8,000 investments valued at about $100.5 million.
Wow.
Which doesn't sound like a lot. It's like $100 million, but you know, that's the money that gets the company off the ground to the point where they can go ahead and raise enough interest from an investment firm to get you an IPO, an initial public offering of stock.
Yeah, that's where the public can purchase stock within that company.
So yeah, you start your company, you get some people to give you some funding to get off the ground, you get moving, then you go to the big banks and say, hey, if we can launch some stock, I know we're all going to get rich.
Yeah.
And once they do that, And the people, and believe me, there were lots of stock watch pages. People speculated all the time about who was going to have an IPO and which new tech company was, you know, are these guys were any good? Who, where they come from, you know, and yeah. people were following which IPOs were coming in the weeks and months ahead so that you could go ahead and buy in on the first day. And in a lot of cases, the stock would shoot right up immediately out of the gate.
Yeah. Yeah. To the point where, if you were not in on it at the very beginning, then
that was it.
Yeah. I mean, there were still people who were purchasing stock prices even at high points because there were, you know, the sky was the limit. There was no ceiling as far as anyone could tell.
Nope.
For these companies. And one of the risks of venture capital, and I find this interesting, mm-hmm. is that there are times where a startup company will get more venture capital than it needs
yes.
to get off the ground.
Uh-huh.
And that's actually a problem. It's not, you know, because the company has to figure out what to do with that money. And it may be like, let's say that there's a company that starts up that needs approximately $20 million in venture capital mm-hmm. to really start. But they get $100 million in venture capital. This is what leads to, this can lead to bad habits, bad practices. For example, and a lot of these dot-com companies fell into this trap where they started spending their venture capital on, let's call them luxuries or lavish, lavish settings.
Oh, yes, because the dot-com companies, a lot of them in places like Mountain View, California and San Francisco area, a lot of them. There were quite a few of them here in Atlanta.
Yeah, actually, Atlanta had a lot. The dot-com crash hurt Atlanta a lot.
If you want to get an idea what it was like at the heyday, go to howstuffworks.com and read Jonathan's article on the Googleplex. Google still has offices very reminiscent of the kinds of amenities that you would see in these places. But one of the cool things about the dot-comers was they wanted to attract the best and the brightest.
Yeah.
So they would load up on things like foosball tables and arcades.
Yeah, they're trying to hire like graduate students right out of school.
Yeah.
So schools like MIT, Georgia Tech, I mean these
Caltech.
Yeah, Caltech. Yeah. These schools were like the seed farms for these companies. I mean, they were going after these students, sometimes hiring them right out of out of college. They haven't even graduated.
Yes, I know people. As a matter of fact, you think of that as being a sports phenomenon. Oh, well, he's not coming back for his senior year because he signed with, you know,
the NFL
joined the draft
or something.
Yeah, the some of these tech wizards, you know, we're talking like, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, they would get pulled out of college. You know, there's an incubator, which is what you call an office space where little companies go, at the Georgia Tech campus that I've been to. And you see like office after office is, you know, there in each office is a little company mm-hmm. that's just getting started. They get a little office space and a chance to get started on their business. But yeah, I mean, if you have this stuff happening right next to campus, it's easy for them to do some recruiting. And also the companies that were slightly larger that had an IPO, they would lure people in with stock options.
Yeah, you would get paid in stock options. And since the companies were doing so well, that made you instantly a millionaire. That's not a joke. There were people who were joining companies and essentially overnight being a millionaire if you were able to consider the stock options as being equivalent to, you know, their perceived market value at the time.
Yes, that's correct. And you have to think about, like, well, okay, so what if I join Giant Internet Co. and I, you know, I just come there and they pay me all these millions in stock options and I, you know, buy the stock and leave. I could just be a millionaire. Well, no, a lot of these had a vesting period. So you'd have these options on paper and you had the right to buy them at a low price. Or at the price at the date of issue. So
right.
If you joined the company when the stock was $3 a share, then you had the right to that. That's locked in. But in order to actually get that stock or the right to actually buy the stock, you have to work there for so and so many years. So in three, four years, you could get your, you know,
you can cash out.
You can get your 8,000 shares of stock at $3 a share. Meanwhile, the stock price had risen to $99 a share. Wham! You've got lots and lots of money. But
unfortunately, it did not work out that way.
Not, well, for a lot of people it did, but...
Well, yeah, for some people it did, but...
That was during the bubble as the stock prices continued to inflate. And, you know...
Yeah, because the bubble started forming, like we said, in the mid-90s, and it really reached its height in 2000.
Yes, and again from the article in the Chronicle, March 10th, 2000.
Ah, yes, the peak.
This is the NASDAQ, one of the stock exchanges here in the United States.
Right.
It's not exclusively a tech stock exchange, but
there are a lot of tech stocks
on there. The NASDAQ hit its peak of 5,132.52. And then it virtually overnight crashed. Now, the low point of the NASDAQ was a couple years later,
right?
October 9th, 2002, where it reached 1,114.11.
That's a 78% drop.
Yeah, over
two and a half years. 2.5 years, 78% of the value of that stock exchange gone.
Well, that's because of a lot of things. So a lot of the tech companies delivered on their promises.
Yeah.
But yeah, not all of them did.
Let's talk about some of the companies that started during this bubble.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few that are still around. There's eBay.
Oh, yes.
Which did quite well.
Mm-hmm.
There's Amazon, which followed a pattern that a lot of companies followed. Amazon made it work and most of the other companies did not. And that was the pattern I was kind of talking about earlier, where you try to get as many customers as possible, and then you figure out a way to make money from them.
Yes.
Amazon followed this get big, get fast, and then make money. So the idea was that, all right, well, we need to hit as many people as possible, because that was the promise of the web, correct? I mean, you think of your average store, all right? Mm-hmm. Your average physical brick-and-mortar store. There's a limit to the number of people who can go in and out of that store in a single day.
Yes, if you really want to get into depth on this, you can read Chris Anderson's article in Wired Magazine, The Long Tail. He actually did a book on that, too, that might be available at your local library. But Jonathan's right. You've got your local store, but, you know, it's also got so much it can carry. So you're limited to the stuff they think they can move. When if you want something that was published 15 years ago, it may not be on your local store shelves anymore.
Yeah, so you've got a physical limit to how much you can have. You have a physical limit to how many people can visit.
Mm-hmm.
You're regionally based, right? So,
yeah.
I mean, there's going to be a limit to how far people are willing to travel to get to your store.
Yep.
But on the web, all of those disappear.
Yep.
Right? Because you can have an unlimited number of people. Well, assuming your bandwidth can handle it, you can have a virtually unlimited number of people visit your store.
Yep.
You can have a virtually limitless inventory because you can always order whatever. Like if you start selling out of something, you can always order from the manufacturer more items of that until that dries up.
Right.
And there's no regional limit, essentially. Now, you might be somewhat limited by whatever country you're in, but mm-hmm. that's a lot different than being, like, if I have a store in Atlanta, Georgia, and that's my only store, then essentially I'm catering to Atlanta. But if I have a website, and my website's based out of Atlanta, but it goes everywhere, then my customers are the world. That is a phenomenal thing.
Yes. Now, I mean, you have something else, too, at your disposal, which is a method of communicating with potential customers. Now, Jonathan's store here in Atlanta, Georgia, you've got people, word has spread throughout the state, maybe to neighboring states like South Carolina, Tennessee, Alabama, and Florida. And, you know, people buy something here and go home. So, you know, five or six people in New York, a couple people in California know about Jonathan's store and they think it's cool. Maybe he comes out with a mail order catalog and gets some more business.
Or maybe I franchise.
Or maybe he franchises. But the thing is, the word of mouth is spreading. And there's only so much advertising he's not going to put TV ads on in Wisconsin.
Right.
Because they can't come into the store or they could get a catalog. And, you know, of course, there are many, many success stories, people like Sears who managed to make that work. But that's a painstaking process.
It's a hard road.
The internet makes that so much easier because using search engines, you can find, it's like, you know, new and used books. Where am I going to find? Oh, there's a store called Amazon.com. What's here? And then, you know, Amazon, for its part, too, only has to maintain a handful of warehouses. They can put one in the Northeast. They can put one in the Southeast. They can put one in the Midwest.
Right.
They have four or five buildings from which they ship stuff in the United States. They keep their overhead low. People aren't browsing through and damaging copies. People aren't shoplifting.
Yeah.
There are many advantages that the internet gives a store that it wouldn't have. And so e-commerce was one of the huge things that happened during the dot-com boom because,
right.
You know, and it scared the willies out of other stores. I mean, Barnes & Noble
and
Borders, you know, which are big chains here in the United States, immediately, you know, started working on, well, probably not immediately, but started working on some kind of online strategy, and not everyone has succeeded at that.
Yeah, see, Amazon, they got big fast, but they didn't overspend,
no.
Right? They didn't invest in warehouses they didn't need or technology that was superfluous. They were very wise about their spending choices, and that's part of what helped them survive the eventual crash.
Mm-hmm.
eBay had a very strong community at the time. Still does, but it was a little different because back then we're talking mainly auction based transactions. Now today it's changed a little bit, right?
Yep.
It's closer to Amazon than it used to be.
True.
And then you had Craigslist that also started during the dot-com boom, and that was a different model entirely because that was sort of an extension of the old BBS community boards.
Yep. Well, and. Correct me if I'm wrong, but both eBay and Craigslist were local operations until, you know, word got out and people started saying, hey, I want this. I want to be able to, you know, eBay was initially designed to be for the San Francisco area, right? The Bay.
Right.
So that's it's just funny how, you know,
and Craigslist as well. San Francisco, man, you guys with your little Silicon Valley and stuff.
Yeah.
But there were other big sites that also started in the boom that didn't ultimately do so well, like GeoCities.
GeoCities. Yes.
GeoCities actually got so big that Yahoo decided to purchase them in 1999 for an enormous sum, $3.57 billion.
And where is GeoCities now, anyway?
It's gone.
Yes.
Yahoo shut it down in 2009.
Yeah.
So you know that it was one of those purchases that at the time it seemed like it was a wise decision because everyone was getting a GeoCities account, and we saw so many terrible websites with looping MIDIs and animated GIFs.
Oh, yeah.
And there was the required under construction image that had to be on there somewhere.
With the guy with the shovel?
Yeah, usually the guy with the shovel, or it was a hard hat, or it was like the tape. But yeah, there was always an under construction. And guys, yeah. Just so you know, if you're building your first website, I know all of you know this. We understand it's under construction. The web is a fluid thing, so you don't need to tell us. It's always going to be changing. But also AOL mm-hmm. at that time. This is how big these companies were getting. Okay, so during this boom, AOL, a web-based company. Now, granted, they had started off with sort of a...
They were an OSP.
Yeah, an OSP.
An online service provider. So they weren't part of the internet. You dialed directly into that.
Yeah,
did a podcast.
Yeah, they were their own network. But then they, of course, transitioned to the internet.
Right.
When the web started to take off. AOL acquired Time Warner. This was a huge story. Still is, actually, because now it's looked at as one of the worst business decisions of all time.
For now, anyway.
Yeah.
I'm sure someone else will do something even more crazy.
But at any rate, it's one of those where... In retrospect, it was one of those things where just because a company can do something, maybe it shouldn't.
You know? Yeah.
It might not need to. So, but there were other ones like Pets.com.
Oh, Pets.com
yeah.
was one of those. There were many. there are many of these startups that became big, and you can look back on them now and go, "What on earth were they thinking?"
Right.
But Pets.com. was not one of them. It was an online pet retailer. So, I mean, not pets, but pet supplies.
Right, right.
And their commercials were very famous because they had a talking hand puppet dog
yes.
with a microphone.
Yes.
He actually went on to work for someone else.
Right.
But Pets.com, you know, just did not end up working out. And, of course, the major pet stores in the United States here all have an online presence sort of like Pets.com. But at the time, I guess we weren't ready for it.
Yeah, I can tell you, if you want to hear about some big companies that, or some companies that made big news in the world of failure, Boo.com is hard to beat.
Yeah, Boo.com. Of course, if you're in the United States, you may be going, I'm not sure I've heard of them, but in the United Kingdom, I bet you have.
Yeah, Boo.com, fashion, yes, clothing, mm-hmm, supplier, website. So Boo.com spent over $100 million. The company spent over $100 million before ever offering a single article of clothing for sale on its site.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they decided to push the envelope and be really cutting edge with their tech. So there was an animated personal assistant, a sales assistant, who would help you on, mm-hmm, the site so that you have this animated character. The problem was, at this time, in the late 90s, early 2000s, people were still using dial-up. You know, the broadband was not an option. And so using something as broadband intense as an animated character to deliver your product or to deliver the experience to the consumer meant that it was even harder to get there and to experience it. So in its brief life, it sold just a few hundred thousand dollars worth of clothing to around 300,000 customers. And it spent over, in 6 months, spent $188 million. So, you know, that's like the classic story of the dot-com crash, right? A company that just balloons beyond its capacity to deliver upon the promises,
mm-hmm,
and then burns through way too much money buying things that are not core to the business. And then as a result, once everyone says, hey, whoa, wait a minute, maybe we're overreacting, maybe we're overvaluing these companies, it crashed hard. Another one that I was very sad to see go was Webvan.
Yes. Now, for a while, there were a couple of competing stores, at least here in Atlanta. I know there were others in other parts of the country. Webvan, I believe, was at least semi-national here in the United States.
Yeah, it was in several cities across the country. Yeah. It wasn't nationwide or anything, but there were like 8 or 9 cities, and it was a good spread across the country.
Yeah, and the idea was you would order your groceries online.
Yes.
On the website, and someone would deliver them to your house.
Yes, within a 30-minute window. You would tell them approximately what time you would be home, and within 30 minutes of that time, you should receive the delivery.
So, actually, I don't know anybody who tried Webvan, or...
I did.
Would you let me finish?
Okay, go ahead.
Or I believe the other here in Atlanta was a Home Grocer?
Might have been. I don't know. I was a Webvan customer.
I don't know anybody here in Atlanta who tried those services and didn't love them.
Oh, my God, I loved them.
And I think virtually everything else I've read online about them was not positive. Extremely positive. The problem was that they were suffering from poor adoption. People didn't, I don't know that they didn't necessarily know what these companies were, but they, in a way, it's kind of a throwback to old style services like, you know, the milkman delivering these things to your house.
Right.
Maybe they considered it antiquated, but for whatever reason, none of them really took off. The Florida grocer Publix was also considering a move into that and abandoned that. There are some places where there are services like that have slowly crept back in. Peapod for a while was sort of making a niche.
And you may have heard of things in your area, community supported agriculture, CSAs.
Yes.
These are farms that sell a certain amount of produce that's produced. Usually there's some sort of collective involved, and you might pay a weekly fee and you get a delivery of produce sent to you. So that's kind of similar, but
yeah,
it's on a much more regional, like a very local base as opposed to national.
Right.
One of the things Webvan did, besides the fact of a poor adoption that led to its downfall, was it spent a lot of money too.
Yeah.
It spent over $1 billion on warehouses. And it spent faster than it could bring in money. And so once confidence began to waver in the tech market overall, there was no way it could cover its costs. And thus it went bankrupt in around 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And actually several companies did go bankrupt around that time, the 2001-2002 period, because that's what was happening. People started to realize very quickly in 2000 that the companies they had been investing in, they had overvalued. There was no way that any company could deliver on that potential
right.
at that stage in its life. And as a result, people began to abandon in droves. And there were other reasons that contributed to people getting out of the market. Interest rates were going up. It's actually a really complex story, and there have been books written about this. But in general, what happened was people abandoned ship. And as a result, these companies, their value plummeted. So the company that had been worth millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, mm-hmm. is now effectively worthless. They don't have the money to pay their overhead. They can't pay their employees. They had to start laying people off. All those stock options that were initially worth potentially hundreds of millions of dollars were now, you know, you hear stories about people just like having boxes of stock options or stocks that were worthless, that you could have turned it into, you know, packing paper if you wanted to.
Yeah.
And so if you didn't cash in at the right time, you were out of luck. And as a result, also, the job market became glutted with tech people.
Yes.
Especially like web administrators, IT professionals. Mm-hmm. You suddenly had an influx of all these tech folks and not enough jobs because the companies that had been supporting them didn't exist anymore.
Yep. And this is, you know, it eventually settled out, but not before a lot of tech people lost their jobs and a lot of theoretical money on stock options, and a lot of real investors lost a lot of real money on their investments too. And of course, it's made people very wary, which is why these days, when people like Groupon are talking about the possibility of an IPO, people like Facebook,
Twitter. Twitter's a really good example, actually.
Yeah, Twitter is particularly nerve-wracking because if you think about the definition of the bubble, people are excited about it, but Twitter has been sort of reluctant to give us a business plan that's publicly available so that we can see it. So, you know, a stock might go up, and if the company can't say, oh, yes, well, we raised this much money through, for example, advertising, you know, that's what has people talking about it again. But I think people in general are more wary than they were in the early 2000s.
So.
And they also have an idea. People are more tech savvy as a whole than they were back then when everything seemed like, oh, that's a really neat idea. Like, yes, it's a neat idea, but you can't pull it off.
Yeah, you still see stories. I mean, there were especially a couple of years ago before we had the economic downturn again. You heard stories about venture capitalists sinking more money into various ventures than you might think is wise. But in a lot of cases, those panned out not because the companies were successful, but because some other larger company came along and acquired it for quite a bit of money. And then the investment pays off that way, which, I mean, that's another, like, you're making a long shot bet. So you might think, oh, this little company here that's just starting up needs venture capital. I don't see it as being particularly successful in any way that's going to generate a lot of money, but I bet Google's going to buy it.
Yeah.
Then you would go and you would invest in the small company with the hope that Google would come along and munch it up. And, you know, the way things are, you'd probably have a 70% chance of being right. Yeah. And that's not to say that Google would do anything with it that would be successful. It just that seems to be the way it works. Now, I love Google, and they have done some wonderful things, but some of their purchases have not really worked out, Jaiku.
Yeah, I knew you were going to pick them.
Dodgeball.
So we'll have to see where it goes. I think the market's going to be a little bit more cautious, and if there is a bubble, it won't inflate so spectacularly as the last one did.
Yeah.
Probably simply because it's so close in proximity to the previous one. But that doesn't mean that people shouldn't try to get some investment and move out there.
Sure.
I hope to see that. There are more new tech companies willing to make the plunge. You know,
we definitely don't want to see innovation suffer.
No,
right? But
money to make it happen.
We just got to be careful because, I mean, I can tell you, Atlanta suffered quite a bit after the .com crash. Yeah. I worked for a company that was not directly related to tech, but had a lot of clients that were tech companies. And once that crash happened, the revenue for the company I worked for suffered. So that kind of thing can happen where even if you aren't directly related to it, you feel that impact. I mean, and of course, I was a Webvan customer. So when Webvan went belly up, I didn't have a car at the time. I lived a mile away from the nearest train station, and then I'd have to take a train and a bus to get to the closest market. and then I'd have to carry all that stuff back. It web van was exactly what I needed at the time. Now, yeah. You know, so I keep hoping for something like that to really start to make its way back, even if it's locally supported as opposed to being a big national chain.
Yeah, I would imagine that the failure probably still has some people wary, but I think it could succeed given the opportunity.
Yep.
We'll see.
All right. Well, that was a great discussion on the .com crash. If you guys have any input, if you were directly affected or indirectly affected by the .com crash and you want to share your story, you certainly can feel free to do so. You can shoot us a message on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle at both of those is TechStuff, HSW, or you can shoot us an email, and that address is TechStuff@HowStuffWorks.com. And Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does all the work for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. Visit Picasso to see thousands of listings. That's PACASO.com.